In these two seminars, I want to make mainly opening remarks and then have a discussion with you, because I think that would be much more interesting, both on the themes that I've suggested in some of the things in the paper that's been circulated to you, but also things that occur to you as you think about these issues. So I hope we will succeed in doing that. The essay that was circulated to you, Life in the Fast Lane, it's now published as Chapter 12 in the second edition of Mad Cows and Mother's Milk, which came out in December from McGill-Queen's University Press. All the really interesting stuff in that essay is by Mike Schenko, my co-author, and so don't ask me too many questions about it. Mike is a microbiologist and a PhD in microbiology and a gene jockey, fooled around with the antifreeze gene. So he knows what he's talking about in those things, and I just try to get by. I hang around with scientists and try to get by. I have some opening remarks and some additional references and illustrations and websites. This file would be available electronically from Arthur if you want to follow up on it, including some of the web materials. I have three general presuppositions for this set of two talks, and they are the background to or what generate the questions. The first is that what I call the core project of molecular biology will certainly be completed and relatively soon. In fact, they always beat all of the targets they set for themselves in this field. By the core project, I mean the proposition that there is no foreseeable technical obstacle to fulfilling the following ambition, namely to do anything we wish to do with the natures of living organisms of all types, anything we wish to do, adding or subtracting traits, or modifying traits, or fundamentally altering them by virtue of our power to manipulate their genetic structures. And secondly, to go beyond that, actually, although that seems good enough, to go beyond that, to create de novo, or from scratch, other living species who have never before existed on Earth. This is the project which seeks to find what is called a minimally necessary genome. It's discussed toward the end of Life in the Fast Lane. That has to do with building a platform on which you would use the existing structure of DNA, four nucleotides, and create organisms that have never appeared in natural evolution. But even more ambitious, there are some who think they can create a new type of DNA entirely by adding other nucleotides to the four, the ACGT. And thus bring into being entirely novel forms of life, unlike anything that has existed before. Not many of you are biochemists. I'll just show you some nice, very quickly, some nice graphics. Arthur is very pleased with his technology.
I gave Bill lessons this morning.
We'll use it. This is a nice site maintained by the University of, I think it's Utah. Which has some very, very nice graphics. DNA. Four nucleotides, endlessly recombined. They occur in, or they are functional in triplets. Each triplet can make an amino acid. They can make 64 combinations, but that's just different ways of making 20 amino acids. This shows the, obviously, double helix ability to split and copy itself. And out of the amino acids, you make proteins. There are only 20 amino acids. They make all the proteins. Some of them are like four sequences of 400 amino acids. They're very elaborate structures. And proteins do everything, do all the work, create tissue, create enzymes, create hormones, create everything that makes a living organism work, whether it's a plant or an animal. There are some other very nice graphics on this. I basically rely on this, and every once in a while I forget and go back and look and refresh my memory, or I ask Mike, which is even easier, explain it to me. It's not necessary for us to go into the details of replication and so on, but basically this is what it means to say, to be able to do anything we want to do. What it is is you sequence that whole thing for an organism. They've done it for mice, for chickens, and for humans. That means you have a complete record, when it's printed out, it looks like a barcode, of those sequences. And in the human genome, if you take each one of those, the 18, you see there are 3 billion of them. That's the code tells the cell what to do to create a human being, from first cell stage, when the first fertilization occurs, to a mature adult, which has a trillion cells in his body, each of which has a copy of that sequence. So the human one is 3 billion base pairs. The Human Genome Project sequence, in the sense that they know what all of those points are. But that's only the beginning, because then you have to find the genes, which is what really does the work, which basically tells the cell when to produce proteins and to make more, or has too much and make less. There are 30,000 of them. It does that once in a while. It's not true, actually. Very handy site. That gene is just a chunk of the DNA. About 3,000 base pairs on average makes a gene. We have about 30,000 in the human genome, and that accounts for 2% of those 3 billion base pairs. They don't have a really good idea what the other 90% does. We often hear references to junk DNA and so on. I suspect actually they will find out what it does. The main process to manipulate that is to figure out how it gets switched on and switched off. The same gene gets switched on and off many different times in many different cells, and actually, depending on the type of cell, the same gene can produce very different proteins. They are incredibly versatile. It's an amazing device, DNA. And so what you want to do then, after you sequence the 3 billion base pairs, is to find these sections. So they work chromosome by chromosome. Certain chromosomes, like chromosome 7, which is one of the largest human chromosomes, has been finished. It was published last fall. The Canadian team was the lead on it. I think it was last fall or sometime last year. Chromosome 7 is very important. Has about 200 to 300 disease genes on it, genes that produce some inherited diseases, and so it's a very great interest to find out where they are and whether or not you could do anything about them, gene therapy. So you have to find the genes first, and then if you really want, then you have to find out how they get switched on and switched off. The genome is amazing. There's this 3 billion, and one gene can be here, and the regulator, the thing that switches it on, can be up here. Tens of millions of base pairs away from the gene itself. But that's what actually switches it on, starts a cascade that tells it to make more protein. And when to stop, that's enough. So what you want to do is find out what each gene does, what proteins it creates, and thus what forms of tissue or chemicals it produces, and then how to switch it on, how to switch it off. And then you can play with it. You can play around with it. You can change it. You can delete it. You can add genes. You can add genes from different organisms. Why? Sounds weird, but because DNA is the same in all living things, plants and animals. ACGT, everything that lives has that code. And so you can actually put a flounder gene in a strawberry, as they did to try to make it more cold tolerant. No problem. What else would you like to do? So you find out how it works, what switches it on and off, what it does, and this will take some time, but it's a mad pace. And because genes do multiple things, that's called pleiotropic, many things, many powers, and there are many genes that work together. So these are, it's not true that one gene does one thing. So it'll take sophisticated understanding, but the point is there is no obstacle to completing that understanding. All the basics are there, they simply have to do the work. So, what we'll have when they're done is to know how every living thing works, and that is how it is produced, and how to change it if we want. Add, subtract, you name it, whatever. Change its traits, change its characteristics. And then, as I said, to create new things from scratch, either with the same DNA or potentially things that have never existed on Earth because you're using a modified DNA. So that's the core project. Second thing I need to note as background to this is that for thinking beings, that is the higher mammals, including humans, but including also my beautiful dogs, who are thinking beings, for thinking beings, this power that the Molecular Biology Project will exercise, it's very important to know, will be applied to mental as well as bodily processes. I'll give you an example of that. And the first is, we can do anything we want with living things, including make new ones. We will be able to manipulate mental as well as bodily function. We find out what the genes do that code for brain development. And thirdly, my third presupposition is that this is an extraordinary form of knowledge, unlike, I believe, anything we have had before in human thought and technology, because it is knowledge about how we were produced. And we tend to invest that with great significance, whether we frame it in a purely naturalistic form as the product of evolution with no guiding hand, or in a religious framing, but it is how we were produced, and the capacity to monkey around with it. There's no other knowledge like that before this. Most other technologies have been technologies to control the external world, and to control humans by constraining them through terror or a physical deprivation or whatever, externally control them. But this, we're talking about the core of our being, of what we are. So the third presupposition is that this is such an extraordinary form of knowledge that we can only deal with what it implies, I believe. If we leap ahead to the point in which the project is completed, it may be little more than 10 years at the current rate. Certainly less than 20, is my guess. They always beat the targets. And for example, the Paul Allen Foundation, the co-founder of Microsoft, put $5 billion into Special Medical Foundation a year ago that has its objective to fund neurological genetics research to find out, to find all the brains, all the genes that, that code for the development of this extraordinary organ, the human brain, and do it in 5 years. Find out where they are and what they do. They have always beaten those targets. So I think it's certainly less than 20, it may be 10 years by the time the project is completed. But it seems to me the implications for this are so vast, unless we start now, we have no chance of actually bringing this project under what I call, to use the old terminology, rational control, the control of thought or value-based thinking. You know, yes?
Bill, can you say what you mean by completing the project?
Yes. To find
all
the genes.
You mean finding what the function of every gene and combination of genes is in an organism.
Yes, and how to switch it on and off. For each organism, that is completing the project. Thus, you know how to manipulate it. You know where it is, and once you know where it is, you already know how to deal with it. You already know how to delete single nucleotides or add. The paper Mike described some of those things. We already know how to manipulate that because we've done it with plants a lot. Animals are no different.
So what about the environmental interactions?
That I'm sort of leaving aside.
Okay.
Those are obviously very important, but the molecular biology itself has the project to complete this mastery. It's true that you don't necessarily know what happens when you throw it out there, but they don't worry about that too much.
But I'm speaking of the environmental interactions between gene and environment.
Well, yes, especially for the genes in the brain, the development of the brain, that is true. So there is this other dimension to it. But as the example I'll show you, the molecular biology project itself will try to find the molecular pathways that are implicated in certain types of behavior. Then you can worry about the gene and environment interactions once you've got that down. I'll come back to this, and I'll give you one example of what I mean, because for brain development, it's obvious you do need that interaction. But for molecular biology, you just need to find out how it works and where in the genome the certain particular functions arise. And how they are controlled or modulated. But let's come back to that. So the other proposition is that unless we look ahead and work backwards to the present and say, this is, we've got to try to get a handle on this, what will happen, I believe, is that we will simply be reacting to each new stage. And by and large, our reaction will be incomplete because what the public will hear are the huge benefits. They will announce that since they've known for a long time where the gene is that's responsible for cystic fibrosis, we know how to fix it. Who's going to think that's a bad thing to do? Almost nobody, right? Okay, go ahead, let's do that. Or they already know where the error is in that 3 billion base pairs that results in Huntington's chorea, a terrible disease that strikes down people like Woody Guthrie in their 40s. And they feel fine, and it's one of those neurological diseases where your body just disintegrates around you and your mind stays sharp as a bell so you know what's happening. Lovely. And then it kills you. It's a little mistake. There's a place in the genome where a certain triplet is supposed to repeat 6 times, but the tape gets stuck and it repeats 45. That's Huntington's chorea. Slip it out. No more Huntington's chorea. You know exactly where it is. But each one of these things, who could say this is a bad thing? Or someone will come along and say, we know how to give old people whose memory is decaying more memory. A few more megabytes. Because we now have drug therapies because we know the biochemistry of memory formation in the brain. There are already companies, okay, who are looking to commercialize technologies in this area. The research was done by Eric Kandel, won the Nobel Prize in 2000. who found out how the mechanism in all mammals, which short-term memories convert to long-term memory. Unless you have that mechanism, you never learn. You only have instantaneous experience. We know the biochemistry of that. He's already got two companies out there to basically synthesize the proteins and create basically therapeutic regimes that will affect memory formation. This is happening at a pace you wouldn't believe. But so all these things will sound good, and then all of a sudden it'll be done. And then someone will come to you and say, well, we're going to go in there and change the, I forget whether cystic fibrosis is a single nucleotide, I think not, but there's some genes that just one mistake in that 3 billion, one single mistake, in which you got a T instead of a G. Fix it. Now when I'm in there, what else would you like me to do? And I'll come to this in a minute, in cosmetic neurology. So, this is a two-part discussion. And in general, I could sum up the questions I have for us to discuss in the first session. What implications does the human mastery of genomes, that is human, animal, and plant, have for the individual as citizen, for the family as social unit, and for our system of politics and governance? And I'll give you a couple of examples of what I mean by questions that they raise. Some of them are raised in the Life in the Family essay. When we come to the issue of gene enhancement, that is giving people a little more of everything, including mental function, you run up against the problem that, I wouldn't mind having my kid have a little few more IQ points, that for all those behaviors, which are behaviors in a competitive society, this is a zero-sum game. If I get more for my child, what about you? You'll need a little bit more than I got. Because the importance about social games, which are games for who comes out on top in terms of prestige or power or money and income, especially for our society, it's the difference that counts. Relative difference. This is stuff I was doing in the 70s and social limits to growth and so on. Relative difference is the key to social dynamics in an open and competitive society. So if I get a little bit more for my kids, you'll need a little bit more extra for yours to maintain, just to maintain the status quo. And I often think of when you read about the things that parents do to their children in societies like South Korea and Japan, where by the age of three, they have tutors, they're going to special schools, and this continues right up through the whole schooling. I mean, they torment their children in this competitive game. If someone comes along and says, while you're carrying the fetus, we could do a few things and it would give you a little more of this, do you think they're not going to do that?
We do that already with spina bifida and all sorts of nutrients.
So this is, I want to talk about the implications for the individual as citizen, the family as social unit, and politics and governance. And in the second conversation, what implications does the human mastery of genomes have for the concept of the person as autonomous agent, as moral agent, in both the secular and the religious framing of that concept? The concept of the person as an autonomous moral agent for intergenerational relations. For example, germline gene therapy, which would change the sex cells or gametes, and so you would pass down the changes you made to your children, and thus they would enter the human genome. For intergenerational relations, and indeed for the possible disappearance of humanity, as we know it, as they say. For better or worse, I would add. It's not necessary that other species would think that's a bad thing. And if we thought that there were real issues in there that were difficult to get a handle on, the other then question is, well, if we think these are important, how do we think we are actually going to get a handle on this? How would we even try to bring this under some kind of control, in the sense that there needs to be some agreement as to what you do to your children's genes, because that might affect me? How would we do that? How would we do it, especially in a world in which science R&D is internationalized? And already you've seen in the debate over human cloning, when countries like Canada and Germany and so on made it a criminal offense, there are some guys who stood up and said, I'll find a place to do it. And this crazy Italian who every once in a while claims that he's got a pregnant woman somewhere in the Middle East carrying a cloned baby. You know, that's probably apocryphal, and the nut bars from Quebec, you know, the Raelians and all that nonsense, they just don't actually have the competence to do it. But on that model, I mean, Life in the Fast Lane gives a quote about work done by Chinese scientists in which they took cloned human embryos to the stage of hundreds of cells just to see if they could do it. And they did. And they threw them in the trash and went on to something else. So, question: how are we ever going to do this? Because this, when I said this was a technology of unique power, it's also a technology of elegant simplicity. Already, every graduate student in molecular biology is fooling around with genes, putting things in, taking things out, this, that, that. It gets easier and easier. I wouldn't be surprised if in elite high schools in places like the U.S. where they have, you know, for rich people and lots of money and private high schools, that high school students are already doing this. I wouldn't be surprised at all in preparation for more advanced work in biology. It will be, in one sense or another, a backyard garage operation before too long. It's not like making hydrogen bombs or atom bombs where you need gigantic technologies, centrifuges and so on. It'll fit in a room smaller than this, the essential equipment you need to do that, those manipulations. And one should include bioweapons, and not just things that people think might be good, but fooling around with viruses and bacteria to see what you can come up with. Okay, so that's what I want to do. I opened Life in the Fast Lane with the story about athletes and muscle mass and Dr. Sweeney, which was big in the news a year ago after it was reported in Seattle. I want to give you one example, actually from after the paper was written, by what I mean by the manipulation of mental function and where current science is going and what it tries to do. So this is from an article from last August in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, and the title is DNA Targeting of Rhinal Cortex D2 Receptor Protein Reversibly Blocks Learning of Cues that Predict Reward. So here's what they did. Monkeys, as do, and this is a quote from you, monkeys, as do humans, quickly learn to use visual cues to adjust their behavior based on how much work has been completed and how much remains, that is, their relative workload, before reaching a goal or obtaining a reward. Because of its strong inputs from the ventral visual pathway, the rhinal cortex, which is part of the section of the brain, has been heavily investigated for its role in visual recognition, memory, and acquisition of stimulus-stimulus associations. In addition, we became interested in its role in reward-related learning because of its dense innervation by dopamine-rich fibers. In other words, there's lots of nerve cells that produce dopamine in that section. Using a behavioral task with the monkeys, visually cued reward schedules, that is, you just show the monkey something and they know it means something else. They do a task, they get a reward, and cued visually, in which the monkeys are required to perform multiple operant trials to obtain a reward at the end of the schedule. We previously demonstrated that bilateral rhinal cortex ablations prevent monkeys from learning to use visual cues to make the behavioral adjustment to the scheduled task. In other words, they incapacitated this part of the monkey's brain and they couldn't do this. So they confirmed that that part of the brain was necessary in order for a monkey to be able to carry out this business of scheduling tasks in the expectation of getting a reward. We have shown in this study, this current study, that direct injection of a DNA construct interfering with the function of the D2 dopamine receptor in the rhinal cortex leads to a complete inability to learn associations between visual cues and the workload remaining before reward. In other words, they found it was not just the rhinal cortex, it was the dopamine receptors, the dopamine pathways. And when they blocked those with a genetic manipulation, the monkeys were completely unable to learn how to do this task reward thing. Our findings offer a strong incentive to pursue this recombinant DNA approach as a means to interrogate and modulate the roles of specific components of the molecular pathways underlying behavior. That's what I want to emphasize. What they're after is that each expression of what we call a mental function, like learning, has a molecular correlate or cause or necessary set of conditions. In other words, chemically based signaling, you know how the neural structures work,